Hi, Steve.
How are you?
I'm good. We just finished spending 6 days, was it, in the studio recording Bag of Bones. And I guess my first question for you is, what makes you decide to read the audiobook after you spent however months writing it?
I think that to want to read the book, you have to like the book, to feel that you can spend a little more intense time with the book. And I think some curiosity is also just a prime requirement. You have to know what it's going to sound like out loud. And I'm not a trained actor, obviously. Anybody who's ever seen me in one of the cameos that I've done in some of the movies knows that. But I think writers know how things are supposed to sound, and they know what the temperature gradient of the emotion is supposed to be. So those are some of the reasons to do it. But this is not something I would do if it wasn't a book that I really liked, that I loved in the case of Bag of Bones. I love this book.
And does it change your relationship to the book?
I won't say that it exactly changes the relationship to the book. What it does is it intensifies the book, and you come out of it with a clearer understanding of some of the things that you did and why you did them.
One of the things that's real striking, having read it beforehand and then listening to you read the whole thing, you get to see little games that you're playing with the reader from the very, very, very start of the book. I mean, on page 17, Mike says, "Death was the furthest thing from Joe's and my mind," right? And we know by the end of the book that that's not true at all. It was definitely on Joe's mind, right?
Right, yes, the whole time, yeah.
That's really cool. And you're a fan of audiobooks in general, right? I mean, you like this medium.
I love audiobooks, and I'm willing to do anything that I can to try and advance the spread. Now, it is a little bit like an infection in the sense that once you catch this, you've got the bug and you continue to listen. I listened to my first audiobook in 1979, and I have Ronald Reagan to thank for it. There was a air traffic controller strike. Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers, and I was making a film in Pittsburgh called Creepshow at that time. And because of the air traffic controller strike, I drove back and forth instead of flying back and forth for a while. And I got through the New York Times Book Review. I'd seen these little ads that said unabridged books on tape. And for me, the unabridged feature was a very important one, because I feel that an abridged book, that it being on audio tape doesn't make up for the fact that an abridged book contains less than what the writer had to say in the first place. But these were unabridged, and so I ordered the Thornbirds, and this was in 1979, and I was just immediately wrapped up in the story, and I've been a listener ever since.
And then you and your sons, right, have a game where you have to record for one another.
Well, actually, the way that it started with me was that, first of all, this is a Simon and Schuster audio, and there are a number of audio companies that are available retail that are abridgments. At the time when I started to listen to audio tapes, there were only two or three companies that offered the unabridged tapes. And at that time, they were just kind of getting up and getting rolling. This field has expanded a lot since then, but there were a lot of things that I couldn't find on tape. So at that time, in 79, my daughter would have been, I think, 13 or 14. I had one son that was 11 and one son that was 7. And I began paying them to record things on tape that I wanted to listen to. And they did it because basically they wanted to make a buck. So I paid them $18 a tape for a 90-minute tape. And at first they would stumble and fluff around, but little by little they got better at it. My youngest son recorded his first book, Jim Thompson's novel, The Killer Inside Me, when he was 10, I think, and stumbled over a lot of the words, but so it wasn't a very professional recording in that light. But in a way, they learned to appreciate the joys of stories read aloud. And anybody who listens to audio books, and if this goes on the cassettes, of course, it's the preacher preaching to the choir. But there's a dimension available in audio, in any kind of oral reading that isn't there when you read to yourself. Reading to yourself is like skating. You slide along the surface. Sometimes you skip words. If the story is a really compelling one, you have a tendency to kind of almost dance along so that you're missing some of the nuance that's there. I sometimes think when critics come down hard on popular fiction, it's because they're really not tasting. They're just swallowing whole to get the story. But when something is read aloud to you, you're forced to go at the speed of the person who's reading. You can never peek ahead to see what's going to happen. And you get every word and you get all those nuances. So that there's a little practice involved to really learn how to listen as well as how to perform a book on tape. But it's definitely worth it.
Yeah. Some of the aspects of this book that become really, really salient as you're listening to it, which are what I would call like motivic ideas that keep coming back over and over again. The sunflowers, for mm-hmm. example, which you hear about actually after the fact. You describe the dream in the mm-hmm. first place, but you don't describe the sunflowers. But then when you go and you're living through what you think is the deja vu experience of the dream, then you do have the sunflowers.
Sunflowers are there, yeah.
And then finally, later on, you have them again. Mm-hmm. And there are many things like that. The steno mask, the Vietnamese pronunciation of that Kyra does.
Yeah.
Do you build those things in sort of as you go?
No.
Or how do they...
The things in a book like Bag of Bones that are scary or that are a little bit just... maybe a little bit chilling or just put you off center a little bit, the way... If it's a film, you know, they'll talk about a Dutch angle where the camera is tilted a little bit to one side, just a little bit, so that reality seems to be a little bit off center. It's a technique that the German impressionist filmmaker started in the 20s and 30s. And I think that when you're writing a scary story, that the best thing you can do is to start with a very simple idea and then let the nuances, like the sunflowers that appear and disappear, some of the other elements that come and go. There are refrigerator magnets in Bag of Bones that slide around on the front of the refrigerator. None of those things were planned in advance. That is to say, when I sat down to write the story, I didn't say, well, we'll have these sunflowers that will show up at one point, and then later at the end, or we'll have these fridge magnets. The fridge magnets showed up on their own, on the fridge, and started to move around, and they became a very important part of the story. And there are a number of other elements that are like that in the course of this story. And I think that, particularly for a ghost story to work, that it should have the feel of a dream that's real. My idea of the perfect story of the supernatural, I always think of sewing a garment together or hemming a skirt, something of that nature, where the idea is to make the stitches so fine that the join or the hem doesn't even seem to exist. I would like to be able to take you in the real world and move you little by little to a place where you're in an unreal world. That is to say, if I have a dream of my summer house, and in this dream I see three sunflowers poking up through the deck, and then if I go down there and I actually see those three sunflowers, well, I can say, as people do all the time, that's just a coincidence, or sunflowers grow everywhere out in the country in the summertime. But it still doesn't quite take away that feeling of something really out of the ordinary happened here. And then later on, you get to a point where things are happening in Bag of Bones. It's a ghost story. It's a story about revenge from beyond the grave. There are a lot of supernatural elements. But in order to get there, you have to take readers through this doorway. You have to take them across this little bridge. And to me, that passage from what's real to what's unreal is one of the most interesting things about the genre. And it's also one of the things about the genre that's the most valuable and it's the most practical. Because people say to me all the time, well, you write about this stuff that doesn't exist. You know, you can't believe that kind of thing. But we all seem to understand that we do live in the middle of a mystery. You know, we do live in a world where, you know, we go through most of our lives saying, I see faces in the bushes because of my imagination. But every now and then, we're forced to the idea of maybe I see faces in the bushes because there really are faces in the bushes. We don't know where we came from. We don't know where we're going. We know that we're on this earth and we live a rational life with our friends and our relatives and our loved ones for a period of 20 years or 40 years or 80 years. They're pretty short existences in the wider scheme of things. And the idea of saying, let's go a little bit beyond this mystery and let's go beyond the veil of death is really interesting. But in order to make that work, I think that you have to kind of twist the landscape a little.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question? I don't know if it does.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that's so striking is what makes something so scary in your stories is that the world, the real world that it's starting from, is so real, is so fully realized as the world that we all live in. And underneath that are those invisible cables that you talk about.
And things happen, you know, and I think we all know this, and it's one of the attractions of the genre that it allows us for a little while to admit out loud, even if it's out loud only within the scope of the room where we're reading the story, which is our own head. That's the room between your ears. That things do happen that we don't ordinarily talk about. About 6 weeks ago, I was at a meeting. This is in my home state in Maine. And it was a night meeting. There were a bunch of people there. We had something to discuss. And the meeting started around 8 o'clock and it broke around 9. And I came out of the building where the meeting was held and started to walk across the parking lot to my car. And when I did, the whole sky lit up this brilliant white for just a flash of an instant, and then it went dark again. You're back to stars and moonlight. And I say to myself, well, I didn't really see anything. I said to myself, that was, you had a kind of a brain cramp there for a minute, but you know, you didn't actually see the whole sky light up. And then this woman behind me says, Steve, what was that? Did you see that? And I said, yeah, what was it? And she said, I don't know. And that was the end of the discussion, like that. And the next day in the paper, there was a little news item on one of the back pages. People all over Western and Northern Maine report seeing a brilliant, bright light in the sky. So who knows what it was there, but it was there. And our lives are studded with events like that. And somebody who does what I do, on the contrary of being somebody who's out there and is wild and telling things that could never happen, we're the rational ones. We're the ones who are saying, let us take some of these, you know, events and put them in some kind of context, the context of a story.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way that those old codgers sitting in the general store or whatever, the way that they're scary is based on the way they're really scary in a small town. That
That's
clannishness,
right.
the sort of terror of the familiar rather than of the weird.
Well, when I sat down to write Bag of Bones, I think that I began by thinking about Rebecca, which is the great modern Gothic, the novel by Daphne du Maurier. And it's a story about secrets, but it's also a story about how we make assumptions based on what we see in the world. And a lot of times those assumptions are very wrong. That is to say, for instance, if you go into a bank and you see a portrait in a great big heavy gilt frame, you know, behind the president's desk, and this portrait shows this white-haired gentleman with his hands nicely folded and he's got his beautiful suit on and a tie and it says, our founder, Henry Carstairs, born 1850, died 1923. You make an assumption that this was a responsible man. He looks that way. He looks like a pillar of the community. In other words, it would shock you if you found out that this was a fellow who molested the children or chased the upstairs maids or maybe had burnt down half of the township as a young man. Because we look at people and we assume things based on their looks. And in the novel, Rebecca, the narrator sees the picture of, she is the second wife, the narrator who's never named in Rebecca is the second wife of Max de Winter. And there's a Max in Bag of Bones, too. He happens to be a Max DeVore instead of a Max de Winter, but there's a Max in my story, too. So the unnamed narrator in Rebecca is the second wife of Max de Winter. And when she sees the picture of Rebecca, and Rebecca is so beautiful, she makes certain assumptions about how wonderful Rebecca must have been and how much Max must have loved her and how much everyone must have loved her. And all these assumptions are made on the basis of looks. And this is something that a lot of us do. And we understand on one level that it's dangerous to make assumptions on surface qualities like the way a person looks. And yet we all do it. Well, in the novel, Rebecca, there are plenty of people, including Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper, who understand that Rebecca wasn't the person in the pictures at all, that there was a secret Rebecca, a nasty, unpleasant, twisted, hateful, spiteful, sexually grasping woman who died of a disease that's never specified, but one believes that it's one that was partially caused by her bad habits. So it seemed to me when I sat down to write Bag of Bones that the basis of the Gothic are secrets that are kept combined with appearances that deceive. So I felt immediately right at home because I've grown up in a lot of small Maine communities. What it says on our license plates in Maine is vacation land, and we love it when the Flatlanders come from New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. In the summertime, most of Massachusetts is in Maine. You could go and steal Boston because everybody who lives in Boston at that time is in Maine screwing up our way of life. And if you're from Massachusetts, I'm sorry, but it's true and you know it's true. You come up and you screw up our way of life, but it's all right because you leave your money and we like that. That helps. But the tourists who come see one aspect of Maine. They see vacation land, but people who live there all the time see a different place altogether. We know where the bodies are buried. And in a sense, that's what the real basic Bag of Bones story is about, is finding out where the bodies are buried and who is in the bag, whose bones are in the bag. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and in a way, the scariest moment for me of the whole book is when you think, God, Mike is part of it, too, and he's going to drown his little girl, or, you know. Uh-huh. And in that sense, it's a morality tale. I read it as a morality tale of, is Sarah, the part of Sarah that's in Mike, going to win out over Joe?
Yeah.
And is the marriage stronger than the family ties or whatever?
Right, and it's also a question of whether or not it's possible to rise above the past, whether it's possible to make a break with the past. And it's a story about corruption. And the worst thing about corruption is that it continues to eat away. And Mike is faced with this situation of finding out there's something terrible in himself, and what's he going to do about it?
Yeah. That leads me to the other sort of moral question, which is that Mike decides to stop writing, which it seems to me is a moral decision that he makes after, I mean, he says himself, after the murder of Maddie and realizing that he's imagined and written all these convenient deaths.
Right.
What is the morality of Maddie's death in this book?
That question led to the end of the book. And the answer to your question is, I don't know. And I think that that's okay. I think that a lot of times writers are looking for those answers when they write. And that's part of the motive for writing in the first place. I started Bag of Bones with an idea that I got while I was at the YMCA working out one day. And I started to think about the place where my wife and I, my wife is very much alive, I'm happy to say, but we live on a lake in Maine, and it's a community that's been there for a long time. And I started to think to myself, what if there were a ghost in our house? And that led to questions of, why would there be a ghost? Why would there be an unquiet spirit in this house? And the first answer to come to my mind, and all these questions and answers are going back and forth in the length of time it takes to do, you know, a set of bench press exercises. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to myself, well, of course, someone who was murdered would likely not rest easily until they had gained vengeance upon their murderer. And right away, I've got something cooking. And the story kind of sat there for a while until this girl, little girl, literally walked into the story right up the middle of the road, right up the middle of the highway. And then things started to fall into place. And if this interview we're doing is before the story, I don't want to say any more. And if it comes after the story, the readers who've heard it will know what I'm talking about anyway. When Kai DeVore walked into the story, the story gelled. And one of the moral ambiguities, or one of the moral dilemmas set up by the story, is that Mike Noonan, the main character, who's a 40-year-old novelist, widower when the story starts, falls in love and becomes attracted with a woman who is half his age, a woman he says at one point she is young enough to be his daughter. And in a way, complicating this even further and kind of juicing my interest in the problem was that not only is she half his age, but she looks even younger than that. She looks so young that at the beginning, when he first meets her, when Mike first meets her, he mistakes Maddie, the young woman, not for Kyra's mother, but for her older sister. So the dilemma that's set up there is one that I think any man my age can relate to. There's still a biological imperative where you're attracted to women who are increasingly younger than you are, and by the way, who are increasingly less interested in old guys. It's as simple as that. So in a way, that this is wish fulfillment. But you're attracted that way, and a lot of times, at the same, you realize there's something here that's not quite right. This is not exactly an entirely healthy sort of draw, pull, magnetism, whatever you want to call it. So in the course of trying to work out what their relationship would be, one of the tensions of the book is that there's a genuine love between them, and there's a genuine bond between them in the girl who is, in one sense, Mike's daughter. Because at the time that Mike Noonan's wife, Jo, died, she was pregnant with a little girl who is really interchangeable from Kyra. Mm-hmm. So there's a family unit there which fate is calling him to finish up. So you have that on one hand. On the other hand, you have the fact that he still loves his wife, and this girl is very, very young, half his age. So I've gotten into situations like this before. I love the idea of stories that go in a direction that's considered politically incorrect. One of the impetuses for working on The Dead Zone was I was thinking about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and the idea that assassination, the man with the gun in a high place, is one of the most horrible figures of our time, one of the real 20th century boogeymen, never mind ghosts and spooks. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, the man with the gun in the high place. And then I thought to myself, would it be possible to write a novel and make the assassin, the political assassin, the good guy? And that became the motivation for writing The Dead Zone. And the question that that book more and more revolved around was the idea of, if you could jump into a time machine and go back to the beer halls of Berlin in 1932, would you be morally justified in shooting a Hitler? You know. So, in Bag of Bones, the question became whether or not, more and more, I was interested in, is Mike Noonan going to sleep with Maddie DeVore? Is he going to take her to bed? And if so, what's the sex going to be like? But even more interesting than the sex, one assumes the sex would probably be great for both of them. But what's the conversation going to be like the next day? And what's the conversation going to be like the next week? And what's the conversation going to be like the next year? And I got interested in that. And because of what happens to Maddie, the question was never answered. And I started to think about all the books that I had read where moral dilemmas were neatly solved by a character dropping dead.
You've got a few stories, and certainly in this novel, you have a certain kind of woman who has a certain kind of character, a certain kind of independence, mm-hmm. and it's clear she really loves the guy, but mm-hmm. she has her own life, and there's this sense of her strangeness in the midst of familiarity. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the driving, Mrs. Todd's Shortcut.
Right.
Is another one where I think the character is a cousin to Joe or a sister to Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what relation that has to Tabby and your relationship to Tabby.
Well, Mike, and this might be my favorite phrase in the entire book. Mike describes his wife, Joe, as a brilliant scatterbrain. And obviously anything that a writer does is drawn on some level or another from their own life. And Joe, to some degree, was drawn from my own wife. There's not a one-to-one comparison between Joe Noonan and Tabby King, especially because Joe's dead and Tabby's not. But what I wanted to do was to create a kind of Renaissance woman and to show a marriage where things are working because the two partners complement each other pretty well in the marriage. You have Mike, who has a one-track mind and writes his stories. And he realizes in the course of this one that he spent too much of his time writing the stories and not enough time noticing what's going on around him. And you have this other partner, the woman, who is a sort of Renaissance woman who can do all sorts of things. But I got to say, too, that, again, to a large extent, Bag of Bones is about the difference between what appears and what really is. And in any marriage, there's always a big difference between how that marriage looks from the outside and how it actually is on the inside. So, again, going back to Rebecca, which is where I kind of got my start with this thing, the interesting thing about Rebecca is that the narrator, the young woman who's the second wife, looks at the first wife and says, I could never be that good, I could never be that pure, and it turns out that Rebecca has been leading a double life all along and that she was really a rotten, scuzzy, scurgy person. And I thought to myself, maybe I can do a negative of that to such an extent that it even turned out that there was a negative image of Joe in the book that shows up at the end. And I thought to myself, let's make Joe Rebecca to this extent that we have a picture of her and that her husband has a picture of her, too, as a certain kind of woman, collects mushrooms, takes photographs, and spends a lot of time doing charitable work. She's on these boards for soup kitchens and teen shelters and battered women shelters, that sort of thing. And then let's let him find out that she's been leading a secret life all along, only the difference between Rebecca is that you find out that Rebecca's secret life is a bad one. And after an initial scare, Mike finds out that his wife is actually trying to make things better. But there are secrets, and that's the chief attraction of both the mystery and the gothic, I think. Secret lives.
Again, early on in the book, when Mike is suddenly getting success as a mid-list novelist, mm-hmm. Joe sort of teases him about being hurt that his college teacher, you know, says, mm-hmm. you're no Thomas Wolfe.
Yeah.
And I kept a list of all the books that are referred to in this book. And this is definitely a reader's novel in that there's I don't know, I have like 6 pages of novelist names.
That's really anal of you, Eve, to keep a list of all the writers. But.
And it's a pretty fascinating list, too. I mean, it really cuts across what we think of as high art fiction and popular fiction.
And lowbrow fiction.
Yeah, really down there. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm interested to know is, what do you think that distinction is? Is it at all meaningful? You're certainly not Mike Noonan. You're way better than Mike Noonan. But how do you feel about all that and those sort of artificial categories?
Well, categories of fiction are really artificial, I think. I just like to read, Eve. I love stories, and if I were stuck on a desert island with nothing but a carton of matchbooks, I'd read what was on the matchbooks, you know, draw Fluffy the dog, dial 1-800-LAWSUIT, whatever that happened to be on the matchbooks. But I love to read, and I love different voices. I've never been a snob about it, and I hope that I never will be. That is to say, I think that there are 2 components to fiction. And there may be more, but there are 2 overall basic components to it. One is the diction, that is the way that the writer writes. And the other one is the story, what the writer writes about. My be-all and end-all is a wonderfully written story that I really want to read. That is to say, a book like The Catcher in the Rye or To Kill a Mockingbird, Underworld by Don DeLillo. Huckleberry Finn, maybe The Grapes of Wrath is as good an example as you can get. A book where the prose is so clear and so clean, it just seems to sparkle. But also, it's driving a story that's really great. But that's rare. There aren't a lot of people that can do that. And if what I'm offered is a good story that's told in a workmanlike style, we're never given an example of what Mike Noonan writes about, how he writes. But are we?
Yeah, because the crossword puzzle. So we've got...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But they're just a little tiny bit. Still, if I assume that what he is a good storyteller who writes in a fairly workmanlike style. And if that's what I'm offered, I'll be happy to take that. The one thing that I don't have any use for is a wonderful style and a guy who has no story at all, or a gal who has no story at all. For me, that's like having a beautiful car with no engine in it. I can take an ugly car that has a good engine in it, because then I can still go places. I can still get down to the Tasty Freeze. But if you give me a beautiful Cadillac with no engine in there, I can't turn it into a planter. You know, that's no good. So,
yeah.
But I like to read anything that I can, and it's really elevated my life. It, as Mike Noonan says about writing, it passes the time.
There you go.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Bag of Bones was written and read by Stephen King. Eve Baglarian was the producer, director, and interviewer. The associate producer was Florence Barreau Adams. The production assistant was William Carlino. The recording engineer was Paul Fowley, with editing and post-production by EVBVD Music. The music was composed and mixed by Eve Baglarian, with lyrics by Stephen King. The music was performed by Deanne Sorrell, vocals, Marcellus Hall, harmonica, Anne Klein and Danny Bloom, guitars, Mark Elias and Peter Herbert, basses, and Rich Mercurio, drums. The music was recorded at the Molding Room with recording engineer Christian Kelly. The executive producer was Sandy Moore. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.